Hello everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we are going to be conducting our very first interview on our podcast. Recently, we were contacted by representatives of a new true crime podcast called Suspect Convictions, which debuted in early January. Much like Serial, Suspect Convictions is a podcast told in multiple chapters, and it examines the brutal 1990 murder of a 9-year-old girl named Jennifer Lewis, and the subsequent conviction of a suspect named Stanley Liggins. The case is fraught with controversy, as Liggins has gone on trial for the crime twice, and had his convictions overturned twice. His third trial is set to take place in a few months, so in addition to providing this case's backstory, Suspect Convictions will be featuring its conclusion as it unfolds in real time. The subject of today's interview will be Scott Reeder, a veteran journalist who has been involved in this case since day one, and thought this story deserved its own podcast. But before we get started, just a quick mention that even though we're delivering you a special bonus episode today, The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast about unsolved cold cases, which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and 15 to 20-minute minisodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new minisode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. So without any further delay, let's dive right into my interview with Scott Reeder and talk about Suspect Convictions. So we're here with Scott Reeder from the podcast Suspect Convictions. And before we talk about the case in question and the podcast, Scott, would you like to tell us a little bit about your background as a journalist?
Well, I've been a journalist almost 30 years. Got my bachelor's degree from Iowa State. Got my master's from the University of Illinois at Springfield. And spent about 20 years working for newspapers. I spent 4 years as the managing editor for a national news service that I helped found. And spent 3 years working as the executive editor for a statewide news service here in Illinois. And back last spring, I decided I wanted to try something totally new. So I'm writing a book and producing a podcast, and I'm having a lot of fun.
Excellent, yeah. And I guess before we get into the podcast, I guess I want to ask you about the crime that's featured on the podcast, because you are personally connected to it and have been a part of it since day one.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true. It all started on September 17th, 1990. I was the night police reporter for the Quad City Times, a newspaper in Davenport, Iowa. Back in those days, before our cell phones, we carried a great big walkie-talkie to communicate with our newsroom, and we carried a police scanner to listen to the radio traffic going back and forth between the police cars all over the community. And I was driving over to the police station to look at some reports, and I heard across the scanner that there was a fire at a school playground, and I didn't think anything of it. And then on the other radio, I hear my editor's voice coming, "There's a fire at a school, go check it out." I kind of rolled my eyes and drove up there, and I didn't think it was much. And I got there about the same time as the first police officer. And the two of us walked across the playground to some where we saw some smoke rising from some tall grass. And we got about 2 feet from the fire, and I looked down, and instead of being a trash fire, which is what I was expecting, it was the body of a 9-year-old girl that had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. And it was the most horrific thing I've ever seen in my life. You know, I was pretty young at the time. I was about 24 years old. It was just really rough, really rough. I radioed back to the newsroom what was going on. I stayed there the next 3 hours. I interviewed the medical examiner when he got there. I interviewed the detectives that were there. I saw the firefighters there. I radioed in information all night long. And we know towards the end of the night, there was a rumor that started circulating on the school playground that a child was missing from Rock Island, Illinois, who was 9 years old. Now, of course, you maybe wonder, why? How could she be from Illinois, and this body was found in Iowa? Well, this is where the community that we lived in was the Quad City metropolitan area. Half of it was in Iowa, half of it was in Illinois. While this little girl only lived and lived in Rock Island, Illinois, she was only 3 miles from where the playground was. So they were very close, actually. And they were they always called it the Quad Cities, a community that was joined by a river. You know, Mississippi River flows right between the two. So that's kind of by the beginning. The girl's name was Jennifer Lewis. She was 3 days before her 10th birthday. The detectives managed to identify the body by taking fingerprints off of her school textbooks and then comparing them to the fingerprints of one of the hands that wasn't consumed by flames. And it's just a very tragic story.
Before we talk about the investigation, I guess we could talk a little bit about Jennifer herself. Because what really made suspect conviction stand out to me is how much focus you put on the victim. Like, the second episode of the podcast is pretty much devoted entirely to Jennifer and talking about her life. I remember, to make a comparison to Serial, that one of the criticisms about it is that they focus so much on the accused killer, Adnan Syed, that they didn't spend much time focusing on the victim, Heyman Lee, but that's not what suspect convictions was. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Jennifer?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I'd never heard that criticism of Serial, but that was the one thing I faulted that series of podcasts on, because I said, I thought they did a fantastic job, and I'm not knocking them at all. It just, it bothered me that the victim was kind of ignored in the picture. So I thought it was really important that we look at the victim. She grew up in very tragic circumstances. Her parents met as teenagers while they were serving in a juvenile detention center in Des Moines, Iowa. She was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Shortly after she was born, her parents split up, and her mother hooked up with a guy in Iowa. They lived together for a while, had another child. The man she was living with had some brushes with the law as well. So then they broke up. She hooked up with another man in Des Moines, Iowa. His name was Joe Glenn, and they moved to the Quad City metropolitan area and moved around like 6 times when they were there. He was eventually arrested for on the charges of selling lookalike drugs. And Jennifer and her mother and were living in a house in a rough neighborhood. And Jennifer's mother was pregnant, and she wanted her husband to be around for when the baby was born. So she approached, she needed to get him bounded out of the jail. So she approached a man, according to courtroom testimony, named Stanley Liggins, and asked if she could sell cocaine for him to raise money to make bond for her husband. And she began selling drugs and raised enough money to bond her husband out. And according to what she's told me, Stanley would come and go from the house pretty regularly. He'd drop off drugs to sell and pick up the money that she'd raised. And this is kind of what the relations was. And there was some interaction at this time when he dropped by between Jennifer and Stanley Liggins. So we know that Stanley and she, we know that Jennifer was a very engaging child. She was a very happy child. She was a bit of a tomboy. She liked to wear frilly dresses, but she always got them dirty. She was always roughhousing it with the neighbor kids. She was doing a lot of things. She she had some learning disabilities, but she had a real fighting spirit. She was a really engaging child, and she was very much loved. And people asked me, why are you doing this podcast about Jennifer? And I said, you know, you think about it. If you say the name JonBenet Ramsey, everybody in North America knows who you're talking about. And she's been gone for 20 years, and her life was important, no doubt. Or if you say Elizabeth Smart, people will say, well, she's that girl from Utah that was kidnapped. But if you say the word name Jennifer Lewis, people will kind of give you a blank look, even in the community where she lived. And it's because, you know, JonBenet and Elizabeth Smart were from wealthy families. And my point is that Jennifer's life was precious. It was important. It had significance. It doesn't matter what background she came from or the humble circumstances she was. Her life counted. And in a sense, this series of podcasts is a tribute to her, looking at her life. We want to see justice done in that case. We don't know at this point what justice is. And it may be they have accused the right man. It may be that they haven't. I think one thing that everybody would want in this case is that there's justice to see there. And her memory is held aloft for others to see. I mean, it's an important thing that she's not forgotten.
Yes, definitely. I totally agree with that. Another interesting element of the podcast is that you had plenty of interviews with Jennifer's mother, and I can't imagine how difficult this experience must have been for her to think you have closure and that, like, the right man who murdered her has been convicted of the crime, but she's had to experience this nonstop for something like 27 straight years now, and there still isn't any closure. So what was your experiences interviewing her?
She's had a rough life. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to lose a child. And she obviously loved Jennifer very much. As you said, the man, Stanley Liggins, has been tried twice already. And both of those convictions have been thrown out by the courts. And he's going up for a third trial. And it'll be this May. And, you know, that's got to stress you out. I mean, it's got to be tough. Once you think you have closure, and then all of a sudden it's taken away from you, and then you go through it all over again. So this is really tough on that family, and I can certainly feel their pain.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And on the other side of the coin, there's also an entire episode devoted of suspect convictions to Stanley Liggins, the accused killer in this case. And one other interesting thing about this podcast is you do not shy away from showing his bad side and establishing that even if he isn't guilty of Jennifer's murder, then he still has done some bad things. So why don't you tell us a bit about Stanley and how he came on to be on the radar in this investigation?
Let me just say this about this, too. This is one of the things that I had some reservations about the Netflix series Making a Murderer. They really shied away from telling about the accused person's prior convictions. They touched on them, but they didn't really look at them very hard. I want to give a very honest look at this case, you know, not to make one person look better than they really are, or make somebody work worse than they really are. We just want to be very honest about it. Stanley Liggins was a young man. He was born in segregated Mississippi in the early 1960s. He was one of eight children. I believe there were five or six different fathers of the family and of the kids. He grew up desperately poor in a home without electricity or running water. They didn't even have an automobile. They had a horse that they would ride into town and out of the backwoods of Mississippi to get groceries or whatever. It was a very primitive, difficult life that he was born into. And, you know, his siblings talk about how he liked to sing, how he was a very engaging child, how he was a very hard worker. They talk about a lot of things. They're in a very positive sense about their brother. He, at age 18, he tried to rob a grocery store in rural Mississippi and was arrested. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison. He was sent to the Parchment Prison, the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchment. If any of you have ever seen the old movie Cool Hand Luke, that is the prison that this is based on. It's a very, very tough place. I mean, I was out there working on background on the story, and I mean, they had prisoners out working in the fields with a guard on a horse with a gun standing over them. It was just like what you had seen in the movies, you know, the old chain gang sort of thing. I mean, it was a tough place. He did 7 years there. While he was there, he stabbed another inmate 12 times, and he died, and he was charged with murder. He was put before a Mississippi jury. The jury found him not guilty on grounds of self-defense. Exactly the details of that case are a little bit lost in time. No one's kept the transcripts or anything else, but I thought it was very curious that he stabbed this man 12 times in self-defense. I mean, you would thought once or twice might have been enough to defend yourself. I mean, it was a very interesting thing. We know that when he was released from the prison, he moved to the Quad City area. Yeah, he had some brothers and a sister living up in that area. According to courtroom testimony, was selling cocaine to support himself in the community. A little girl in the apartment complex where his girlfriend at the time lived had spilled Kool-Aid on herself, and he had she'd gone to him for help, and he'd gotten a washcloth, and according to the courtroom testimony, he had helped wipe the Kool-Aid off of her, but touched her inappropriately underneath the swimsuit. And he was arrested on that charge, but released on bond. And a month later is when Jennifer died. So what we know about Jennifer's is that the autopsy found that she'd been sexually assaulted and strangled. And, of course, she was set on fire. So the first thing the police did is they went to the family and they tried to hook who the family associated with. And they found, well, what about the Stanley Liggins? He's coming and going from the home. And he's out on bond on a sexual abuse charge. Maybe we should be looking at him. So they took the mother and the father and Stanley Liggins over to the police station and ran them each through a polygraph test. And according to the polygraph examiner, Stanley didn't pass. But you got to, at first I thought that's a really strong indictment. But then the more you research on polygraphs, they're far from a perfect science. I mean, they can be indicative, but they certainly aren't 100%. Sometimes they're just flat out wrong. And everybody agrees that they're, nobody agrees on what their error rate is, but everybody agrees they do have an error rate. So once he failed that test, the whole focus of the investigation just went directly on Stanley Liggins. And they started looking at him and digging, and they didn't find a lot. Other than he had proximity to the family and he had a history of not being a good person. And the prosecutor in the case, of course, here in the United States, prosecutors in every state but New Jersey are elected. And the prosecutor in the case said he went to the others in his office and said, should we charge this guy? And he said, almost universally, they all said, hey, there's not near enough evidence here. He shouldn't be charged. And he said, but you know, Scott, I don't answer to those people in my office. I answer to the voters. And I felt like we had to get this guy off the street. So he was charged Stanley Liggins, even though there wasn't very much evidence at the time. About 3 days later, a woman comes forward and she says that she lived, she was in a house a couple blocks away from the school playground, and she remembers looking out the window of her house and seeing car taillights near a fire. Of course, she didn't know there was a crime going on there or anything. She said she just saw a fire and taillights. And she said, but then she later found out that, you know, there was a crime happened there. And she said, she thought she'd recognize those taillights. Flash forward to the trial. She became the star witness in the case. They rolled in dramatically this back end of a car, unveiled it literally before the jury, snapped off the courtroom lights and snapped on the taillights with a motorcycle battery. And while the woman's sitting there on the stand, she says something to the effect, I'd recognize those taillights anywhere. Those are the ones that I saw. Now, think about that. I can't remember taillights for the life of me whenever I see them. I mean, especially if I didn't know there was something important happening there. I mean, it just strikes me as very odd. Well, then, of course, we find out 20-some years later that before the woman testified, she had become a undercover paid police informant, and she had received more than 80 payments. The person signing the vouchers, according to the appellate court documents, was the same detective that was leading the investigation of Jennifer Lewis's murder. So, of course, that raises some interesting questions in people's minds. And it was never disclosed to the defense that she was a paid informant. It was never disclosed, of course, to the jury. They didn't know that. So it was that's something that really sticks out as one of the more troubling things that has come up. The other thing that came up, the other big witness against this guy was a jailhouse informant. He was sharing a cell with Stanley Liggins. They shared a cell together for about 6 weeks. He was white. Stanley Liggins is black. They didn't speak to each other for 6 weeks straight, and they were watching TV one day, and Stanley Liggins' case came up on the news, and the cellmate named Frank Rising said, "Hey, that's you." And allegedly, Stanley Liggins said, "Yeah, but they'll never get me for it." Well, according to Frank Rising, there was the conversation in the cell was being recorded. Or it's being listened to. And shortly thereafter, he was called out by the police, and they told him, they wanted him to testify. And it was interesting because, this is what all I really knew on the case. And I wanted to hunt down Frank Rising and see if there's more to it or not. And I knew that he was a career criminal. He'd spent more than 20 years of his life in prison. He'd been in and out all his life. And I knew that he had just been released from a prison in Nebraska. And So I drove out to Sioux City, Iowa, where I knew he had family. And I knocked on the door of the house where his mother lived. And I asked where I could find Frank. And make a long story short, his brother calls him up and hands me the phone, and we're on the phone, and I said, "Hey, I'd like to talk to you about this case that happened 26 years ago." And he goes, "I don't want to talk to any reporter." And I talked to him a little bit more, and I said, you know, this is really important. This is one of the most important things you've done. We really think we ought to elaborate. "I don't want to talk to you." And then I said, "Well, you know, I've driven 9 hours to get here, and I really would like to talk to you. But, I'm sorry you had to drive that way, all that way, but I don't want to talk to you." And I said, "Well, hey, guy, you know, I know you've been married before. You know, I'm married, and my wife is just going to kill me if I come back without an interview. Couldn't you give me a break, guy? I don't want to have to deal with that." There's a long pause, and he says, "Okay, fine. Come on down to the construction site where I'm working." And so I guess you get your interview any way you can. I mean, so I drive down there, interview him, and then he says to me something that just kind of blew my mind. He said, they threatened to charge me as an accessory after the fact to murder if I didn't testify. And he said, Scott, I felt like I had to testify or I was going to go to prison for murder, go back to prison for murder. And he said, I didn't want to do that. So he said he was really under a lot of pressure for them to testify. But then the other flip side, I said, is, well, were you offered anything? And said, well, no, I wasn't really offered anything. I said, well, I noticed that you didn't go back to Fort Madison Penitentiary. And for those of you from outside the Midwest, Fort Madison Penitentiary is like Shawshank Redemption Prison times 10. It is a living hell. It is a really horrible place. It was the kind of place where there's stabbings and rapes were very, very common at that time. It was a prison that had been in there since before Iowa was a state. It dated back to Iowa's territorial days. It's an ancient, rough place. And I said, I noticed they didn't send you back there. They sent you to the nice modern prison up at Rockwell City, which is a lot safer place. And he goes, well, yeah. And then he kind of indicated, well, maybe they did reward me for testifying by sending me up there. But, you know, and then he's long paused. He goes, yeah, it is a lot nicer prison. But you know what, Scott? They have cable TV at Fort Madison and not at Rockwell City. And I'm thinking, gosh, daily stabbings and rapes, but they do have cable TV. So, maybe, you know, it's the most odd thing that somebody said to me. So, yeah. So after that, you step back and you think, okay, here are the two most important witnesses against this guy. One of them says he testified because he says his testimony was truthful, but what he said he heard was Ligon say, yeah, but they'll never get me for it. Well, that could be interpreted a lot of different ways. It could be, I didn't do it, so they're never going to get me for it. Or it could mean, I'm going to get away with something. It could mean a lot of different things. But the fact that this guy felt compelled to testify because he was afraid they're going to charge him with murder was something that had never been revealed. The prosecutor in the case says, well, that's just not true. He's just trying to make up an excuse for the stigma that comes with being an informant. But the problem I have with that is, okay, if the prosecutor says this guy's not to be believed when he says that, then why should he be believed on what he said 20 years ago? I mean, if he's lying once, why would he be lying twice? I mean, it just doesn't add up to me. I mean, it's a tough one to all the way around. So these two witnesses, there's a big question marks on both of them. And then you step back. They had over 10,000 forensic samples were taken as the crime scene where the body was found, in the car where Liggins was supposedly driving around with Jennifer, and in the hotel room where Liggins was living. What was interesting is they found nothing connecting Stanley Liggins with Jennifer. Jennifer's hair or body fluids or nothing else were found in the hotel or in the car. And Stanley Liggins, no evidence of him was found at the scene of the fire. So the main argument for his guilt is just one of proximity. Well, he knew the family. He was around them. And he's a bad person, so he probably did this. And that raises some questions in my mind as well.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is one of the most surreal segments on the podcast is when you interview one of the original jurors, a South African, and he has some very bizarre views on race.
Oh, yeah. That was really interesting. One of the things I really wanted to get insight into is what did the jurors consider important when they heard the testimony? And I thought it was very curious when I was looking at the list of jurors that there was a guy who had immigrated to Iowa from South Africa. Because for one thing, this was a black defendant, a white victim, and you know, I would think you would want to keep, you want the most open-minded people you possibly could on the jury. And I'm not saying everybody from South Africa every white from South Africa is prejudiced, because I know that's not true. But you got to remember the era when this trial happened. It was right after Nelson Mandela came to power. And you kind of wonder, well, a white man's immigrating from South Africa right at that time to Iowa, which is a state that's predominantly, overwhelmingly white. Didn't that warrant a few questions, you know, that sort of thing? And so anyway, I call this guy up. He's now living in Florida, and we're chatting, and I'm recording it, and he knows I'm recording it, and we're just talking about the case and everything else. And I said, you know, I've always found as a reporter, the best questions are the ones you yourself feel reluctant to ask, that if you make you feel uncomfortable, because those are the questions nobody else will ask if you don't ask them. And I said, I got to ask you, guy, you're from South Africa. You moved to Iowa right at the time the black majority rule began. Are you prejudiced? There's a pause, and he goes, oh, no, I'm not prejudiced. And I said, oh, that's good to hear. And he goes, I think that blacks worldwide have gotten a bad lot in life. He says, it's important for us to remember that we all originated in Africa. And originally, all of our skin was black. But then he explained, but then we migrate, the white people, the people that are, who migrated to Europe got fairer skin. And they got larger brains. And they became smarter. And I'm sitting there like, he's not really saying this, is he? Is he really saying this? Yes, he is saying this. And he goes, and he says, the people who stayed in Africa lived simple lives, and they didn't need to be as smart, essentially. And it's like, what is this going on here? He's really saying this. And so then I go, well, would it have affected your verdict if you'd known that this key witness had been an undercover police informant? And he goes, long pause, and he goes, no, I don't think so. She was black, he was black, and black people don't scheme against each other, they just scheme against white people. And I'm going, okay. And so, yeah, I mean, for whatever reason, somebody with those views was allowed on the jury. But not only was he allowed on the jury, his wife was allowed on the jury. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
No, that's the first time I've ever heard that.
And it's not like this is some really tiny town. This is a fairly good-sized metropolitan area, but it just ended up that way. So you have that, and that just really gives me pause. I mean, that's not the kind of person anybody would want to have on their jury, I don't think. So, yeah, it was interesting. And, you know, I made a point of calling up a lot of jurors and talking to them. And it was interesting to me is their perception is that people don't want to be on juries. And my experience as a reporter is quite the opposite. Almost always people want to be on that jury. And people say, what do you mean they want to be on the jury? And they say, okay, when they go and tell their employer they're being called for jury duty, it's always like, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I just got to go. But it's a get-to for most people. It's something, it's not a got-to. Most people have pretty ordinary lives. They maybe work on a factory assembly line. They may stand behind a cash register all day. Maybe they're working at a daycare center. They're doing a lot of different things. And suddenly they're being asked by our society to make important decisions, decisions that would affect the rest of a person's life. And it's in a lot of ways, for a lot of folks that I interviewed, this was their 10 minutes of glory. This is the 10 minutes where they were really their opinions really mattered. So people wanted to be on the jury, and they wanted to do a good job. I mean, and how they perceived as a good job. I mean, So, yeah, I mean, it was an interesting assemblage of people. There were some very good people on the jury, too, I might add. But one of the questions I asked the defense attorney in the first trial is, and he's a very good defense attorney. I'm not knocking him at all. In fact, he went on to be a judge for 20 years. He's very respected in the community. And I said, why on earth did you let the South African and the husband and wife on that jury? And he goes, I didn't want to, Scott, but there were 10 Iowans on there that were worse. And I only had 10 strikes that I could knock people off the jury panel. And he said, I just felt like I had to take a risk there. So one person has complained, well, why did you pick on him? Because he was a South African. And then I said, I don't know that I was picking on him. If you think about it, when the defense attorney says there were 10 Iowans that were worse, one could argue we were picking on the Iowans.
One other element of the podcast which surprised me is that you got a lot of interviews with the original prosecutor, Bill Davis, and I found in a lot of these podcasts and documentaries about controversial convictions, the prosecution often doesn't want to talk about the case, but Bill Davis seemed to be pretty upfront about talking about everything. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me at all. When I was a young reporter, I interact with Bill quite a bit. I haven't talked to Bill for more than 20 years. He's now retired. He's about 75 or so. And, you know, I just reached out to him and I said, you know, he's coming up for a new trial. I just want to make sure we have a balanced story here. I hope that Bill is familiar with my work enough that he knows that I'd be fair. And we don't have an agenda here. We're not trying to say this guy is innocent. We're not trying to say this guy is guilty. We're just wanting to present all the facts and let people come to their own conclusions, because I think it's an important case to look at, because there's a lot to be learned about the judicial system and how it works and how sometimes it doesn't work by looking at this case. So yeah, Bill is a very engaging guy. He's very straightforward. I think he really tells it like he sees it. And he's been very helpful through this whole process.
Yes, that is one of the things I like about this podcast thus far, is just how fair and balanced it seems to be, that it looks at the entire case from both sides and doesn't seem to have any bias to it. So at the time we record this, they've only released 6 episodes thus far, so I know there's a lot of information that hasn't been revealed yet.
Actually, our 7th dropped today, so we're up to 7 now.
Okay, I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but I have listened to the first 6. So I know there's going to be more information revealed later, but did you want to talk a little bit about why Stanley's convictions have been overturned twice and a lot of the evidence that was withheld from his original trial?
Yeah, I'd love to. In the first trial, the Iowa Supreme Court threw out the conviction on 2 grounds. One, they said they felt that the fact that there had been testimony that Stanley Liggins had been selling drugs prejudiced the jury against him, and that shouldn't have been brought out. That's one to me is a real head scratcher, because I think it explained the relationship between Stanley and the family. And I'm not sure that it was immaterial to the case, but hey, I'm not on the Iowa Supreme Court, so who am I to say? The second thing was they questioned whether he could have gotten a fair trial in the Quad City area, because the media coverage was just intense there. I mean, the night of the body was found, within half an hour, there were 3 TV cameras 5 feet from the body, trained in on the body with the Klieg lights on, doing live shots, bringing this horrific scene into every person's living room throughout that metropolitan area. It got saturation coverage from the newspapers. It got saturation coverage from the radio stations and just every media. So everybody in the community was pretty well familiar with this case. And the court raised the question, could you possibly gotten a fair jury here? Should you have thought about doing a change of venue to another city? So they decided to change the venue to another city, and the city they chose was Dubuque, Iowa. And Dubuque's a wonderful community. I have a number of friends from college from Dubuque. I think it's the most picturesque community in Iowa. I don't know if that says a lot, but if you've ever been to Iowa, it's pretty flat and unadorned. I love Iowa. It's my favorite state, but it's not a picturesque state like Colorado or some other places. But Dubuque's a very, very pretty town. But at the time, it had had some real problems. There had been cross burnings in Dubuque for 5 years prior to the trial. And the community is the most ethnically homogenous and racially homogenous major city, and perhaps the most racially homogenous or one of the most racially homogenous states in the nation. So it wasn't a very diverse community to move a trial to. And once again, Stanley got an all-white jury. And Stanley didn't do himself any favors at this trial. He got up and after the jury had been selected, but before they heard any testimony, and started swearing at the jury. It's part of the local bar association legend. He was the man who motherfuckered the jury box. He didn't do any favors. That said, that jury deliberated for several days before coming to the conclusion of a guilty verdict. I mean, it was not a cut and dried case. And I think then it came out 20 some years later that 78 police reports had not been turned over to the defense. Now, Bill Davis, he insists this was turned over. The defense attorney insists, no, they weren't turned over. Interestingly enough, both men hold each other in high regard. But, in fact, the defense attorney says, I don't think Bill Davis had anything to do with this. I think it was the police that didn't turn it over. And, you know, we don't really know what happened, but we do know that the Iowa appellate courts found in favor of the defendant and said, we don't believe it got turned over. So we have those 78 police reports that were withheld, according to the court. We also have the fact that this star witness in the case was a undercover police informant. It had been paid. That had never been disclosed. So those two things, along with some other evidence, came up that led to a decision of the court to have a new trial. One of the things that had come up along with this is among those hidden reports was a one that said a woman had come to the police the day after Jennifer's body was found, and she said that she had this was testimony from two of her friends that she had bought cocaine from Jennifer's stepfather. Now, I'm going to emphasize here, this is an allegation, and that's all it is. This is what was in the police report. There hasn't been a finding that was truthful or not truthful. We just know this was the allegation. What it said was this woman had been short of money when she went to buy cocaine. So she went to him and said, hey, I don't have enough money, but can you give me the cocaine in exchange? I'll give you my video camera, and when I have enough money, I'll give you the money and you can give me back my camera. And she alleges that the stepfather said, yeah, I can use it to take photos of sexual acts with me and my daughter. And he supposedly said what kind of sexual acts he would like to do. And, you know, this is important to remember, before the community knew that Jennifer had been sexually assaulted. And they seemed to be somewhat consistent with what was found done to her. Now, you know, like I said, this is just an allegation. This is not, you know, but it's something that was withheld from the defense, according to the appellate court, and that was certainly something they would have wanted to investigate. So there's a lot of things that raise question marks about, you know, was this case as thoroughly investigated as it should have been?
So let's talk a bit more about Jennifer's stepfather, because he has actually been considered like maybe a possible suspect in the crime, and you've been trying to track him down, but you haven't been very successful thus far.
Not from lack of effort, I can tell you that.
Yes.
I hired a vet. I went to a private investigator, got an address for his last known address last spring. I drove down to New Orleans. Knocked on the door of the building that he's supposed to be living in. It turned out to be a facility for homeless people who had substance abuse problems, that they were going through treatment. I couldn't find him there. Returned back up to Illinois, came back last late November, early December with photos of him, and went out underneath underpasses in the middle of the night, showing his picture to a homeless man, saying, have you seen this guy? Do you know who he is? I went out to panhandlers on the French Quarter and showed them. I went to soup kitchen lines and showed the photos. I went to homeless shelters and showed the photos. We found that he was in the computer records at the homeless shelter. We found a lot of people who said they knew him or recognized him. But we never were able to find him. We hunted and hunted. You know, it's possible that once I started asking around about him, the word got back to him and he just laid low. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't live in New Orleans anymore. We don't really know where he is. Nobody seems to know what has become of this guy. But he's just kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting if he shows up maybe before the end of this podcast. You just never know. So
you never know.
Yep, that would be, because this is a podcast being done in real time, so anything could happen between now and the next few months. So I guess that I want to ask you now is, after all these years, what compelled you to decide to do an entire podcast about this case?
The case has always haunted me. It's one that has troubled me in a lot of ways. This poor little girl had been through so much in her life before her tragic death. And, you know, of course I was there that night and I saw her, and, you know, I not only saw the body, I smelt what was on the crime scene. It was just horrific. And I always said I thought her story needed to be told, and I thought it should be remembered. And like I said earlier, I'm doing this because her life matters. Her life counts.
Since this is unfolding real time, we're on episode 7 now. Could you tell us a little bit about what developments we could expect on future episodes? What I find really interesting about this podcast is that you don't know what the ending is going to be, because it's going to coincide with the end of Stanley's trial. So it's completely unpredictable.
Absolutely. And that's going to be fascinating. And that's one of the things that makes this podcast different than almost every other podcast out there. We have an ending. There is going to be closure here. We just don't know what that closure is going to be. We don't know if it's going to be a not guilty verdict. We don't know if it's going to be a guilty verdict. We just know that there's going to be a trial. And there's evidence here. And the other interesting thing is it keeps us honest, because all of this stuff's going to be coming out in the trial. So we have an obligation to present to the public what's going to be presented at the trial and try to show all sides of it and try to investigate some avenues that maybe weren't investigated in the past and do a lot of things. There's going to be some more twists and turns in this case, I can tell you that. I'm not going to get into a lot of specifics, but I think that a lot of people are going to be surprised at what they learn about the case. We're really investigating hard on it and digging a lot of stuff up. I think that your listener is going to be really riveted by it. Again, the name of the podcast is Suspect Convictions. It's risen as high as number 2 on iTunes charts. I think right now it's in the top 20. I'm amazed at the response we've gotten from the public. We've only been up for less than 3 weeks, and we've already gotten hundreds and hundreds of thousands of downloads. It's really become a popular podcast. People are engaged in the case. There's a lot of people that have lots of questions about this, and this is something else we're doing. We're fielding questions from our listeners. We're going to have periodic panel discussions and take questions from listeners and try to answer those questions and go from there. So this is all building to something that's in the near horizon, you know, a May trial. And I think we're going to be covering the trial every day, and we're going to be informing and doing podcasts on what's going on during the trial. So I think you're going to have a lot of different episodes, and it's going to really build to a conclusion.
One thing I'm really curious about is what is going to happen if Stanley's next trial winds up ending in a mistrial. So theoretically, you could be continuing this podcast for the next couple years.
You know, I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I don't think it's going to be going on for a couple years. It's always possible you'll have a hung jury or a mistrial. My best guess is that everybody involved in this case wants closure. And even if there was a mistrial, I don't think there's going to be a plea bargain in the case. I think it's going to result in just another trial, and it'll probably be very shortly after that one. I think that inevitably some sort of ending is going to come to this case. And I expect it this year.
Yes, I'm definitely looking forward to see how this turns out. So before we bring this to a close, do you have any final thoughts, or you want to provide a final plug for how our listeners can access Suspect Convictions?
Sure. Suspect Convictions is available on iTunes and just about every other platform where you can get a podcast. I think you're going to find it's a really riveting case. They can look at some of the photos and original documents at suspectconvictions.com. But I really encourage folks to give it a chance. Just load to iTunes or suspectconvictions.com and look for Suspect Convictions. I think they're going to be very engaged by it.
Yes, I can tell you that I've been very engaged by it so far, and I definitely recommend it to all my listeners listening out there. So thank you very much for being with us, Scott. This was a great interview, and I'm looking forward to see how this turns out.
Thank you.